As the familiar music from the Arctic Monkeys tells us, it's time for another show. Good morning and welcome. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of January. A delight to have you all with us. And thank you very much for tuning in. We're going to bring you in the conversation, as we always do, if you write us a letter, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce our panel to you and get everybody in here and... We're still waiting for one. JP and I just got in, and Fran, I think, was
you, I was
you
early.
Beat us. You beat us all. That's good for you.
I've been here since seven.
Yeah, now I, well, which is late for you, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, here we go. JP Miller is with us. He is the Empire Report, the man behind it, and the man who produces it, and we are thrilled to have him with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm great. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Nice to have you here. Fran Berman is with us. She is the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Joe, how cold is it?
It is. It's darn cold, isn't it? It was, at times... We were, as my wife and I were driving this morning, we looked, and it was 18 below, and we thought, well, wouldn't it, because it started at 16 below, and then as we went down into the holler, I thought, oh, I wonder if we can hit 20, and we did.
You know, I'm a California girl. I'm not sure I believe in negative weather, so, you know.
Yeah. And then, Thursday is going to be like 40. And if you think of that, that's 60 degrees warmer than it was this morning. That's just unbelievable. But
you kids don't know a thing about negative weather. When we moved to Alford, Massachusetts in 1971 full-time, I have to tell you, it was 20 below zero for almost a week.
Oh, geez. All right, I do believe in imaginary numbers, so I suppose I can believe in negative weather. But, you know, okay.
Well, Fran, good morning.
Good morning.
We're waiting for Libby, who wrote me and said she's on her way. It is a jungle out there driving, and so good luck. and some of you who know Libby will say, but it's just from Albany, and I would say exactly.
Yeah.
Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How
Hello,
are you?
Joe. What are the numbers on the lockbox?
I have not a clue, Alan. I don't have a single clue.
I would have said we're doing okay. I'm sure somebody will come running in with them.
I don't think that person is here, so I don't know what our numbers are. I think I can find out though.
Okay, by going to the homepage, right?
But I believe that you are right, sir. That so we're at 430,696.
Yes,
oh, there
she
you are.
Is
okay.
Here.
Hello. Hi. All right, 437.37.
Okay, and she brings with her, Amber, come back here. And she brings with her, 430,734. Now, what you do, if you give to the lockbox, we are starting something today that is going to be extraordinary. It is, I argued for almost a half an hour with Joe and Amber in my office yesterday when they were saying, look, let's just do something really nice for people who are going to give. Let's give them the following package, winter package. You are going to get, for the first time ever, WAMC winter gloves. Now, these are not just ordinary gloves. These are custom gloves. They're made of durable 12-ounce. They're made of durable 12-ounce, 100% pill polar fleece polyester. That's what they are.
They're anti-pill polyester. That's worth a price of admission right there, isn't it?
They're elastic around the wrists. They provide a snug fit and help retain warmth. And they are navy blue with WAMC logo on the gloves.
They're from a special flock of polyesters that are raised in the Adirondacks.
They are. And the logo, it's not just logo, it's in gold.
I believe they're free-range polyesters.
It's in gold.
Which is nice.
So let me tell you, these are winter gloves. You're going to wear them, and people are going to see them. When you go to somebody this morning over to PT, where we go, Libby.
Yeah.
Libby's here, by the way. Good morning,
Libby. Hi, guys.
I heard a client say, I had to fill up my car yesterday when it was, you know, like 8 below, and it was the most painful 2 minutes of my life. Now that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, well, considering
that's worthy of saying again on the radio. You get it because you don't dare touch that metal without gloves on your hand.
I did it too yesterday.
You needed the WAMC gloves.
Fran Berman, you are the best.
So are these gloves warming gloves? Do they have the...
No, that you get the hand warmers.
You get a hand warmer, because there are gloves now that are... Yeah. But everybody get these gloves.
Libby, that's not
get
helpful.
These gloves.
Okay, you get these winter WAMC winter gloves. Your WAMC will be on it.
We could have been later. Go ahead.
And then, as if that wasn't enough, and I've been wearing one of these for a long time now, you get the navy blue, same color, navy blue WAMC logo on it, hat, the winter hat. It's in gold.
It's beautiful.
Look at it.
It's really beautiful. It's a
watchman's
cap.
It's so beautiful, you'll want to wear it in the summer, too.
You would. It's very, very good. So I wear it all the time. Sometimes it pulls a little bit on my hair. And then I get hat head. You know hat head?
Yeah, I have it right now, I think.
Yeah.
And I have to go to the Capitol later.
Ray has just passed by and given me a very dubious look. And so now, to review... We have 430 towards the 500,000 we need.
Did you mention what those run you?
What'd you say?
What do those run you?
How much do you have to give to get the gloves, and how much do you have to give to get the hat?
$120 or more. It's an exclusive lockbox package. You could give $10 a month as a sustaining member, or a pledge of $120 or more. Just this thing is worth $120. Forget about
the hat.
Your radio station.
To keep your head warm?
I'm done.
Absolutely.
I've done the best I can.
All right.
Except for the part about the hat head.
You can do more on that?
No, that just sort of slipped out.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable. Very nice to have you all with us. So if you want to help out, it's WAMC, and my God, don't you want
to? Can you imagine, Joe, having spent your entire life getting to the point of being one of the most exalted names at RPI in what Fran does, which I don't fully understand, and now you're sitting here listening to somebody talking about hat heads and...
I get hat head, too.
Do you?
We all do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless we don't have a head.
You get hat head?
Yeah.
Hard to believe.
Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. Very nice to have you with us. Let us get started. We will go on with find out what's happening in the world and get to your get to the stories of the day. Here we go. We'll begin with what is happening in, this is shutdown related, and we'll tackle this from a couple different sides. The shutdown in the United States is slowing growth in China, which is fueling concerns over the global economy. So you look at all of this as the meeting takes place in Davos, Switzerland. Fears are rising about the state of the world's biggest economies, with China posting its worst annual growth in decades and the United States injecting more uncertainty with tariffs and a lengthy government shutdown. China reported Monday that its economy expanded by 6.6% last year, a figure that would be good for many countries but represents the slowest growth for China in 28 years. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund downgraded its expectations for the global economy, highlighting sharp declines in Europe and warning that the risks of a major slowdown have increased. The pair of announcements come as top executives and world leaders gathered in the ski resort town of Davos for the annual World Economic Forum, in contrast to a year ago when President Trump and other world leaders talked about global prosperity. This year, attendees expressed worry that the United States was undermining its own economy and the rest of the world's via a trade war and the longest partial government shutdown in U.S. history. In the United States, the shutdown has already cut into growth, according to numerous economists. Even U.S. consumers, who have remained resilient for months, have been shaken. Early this month, consumer confidence slumped to the lowest level of Trump's presidency, according to the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey. Who would like first crack? Alan, it's all you.
Call on somebody. Okay, so So here's the deal. First of all, if you were listening to NPR this morning, you learned, as I did, that the major leaders, Macron, can't go because of the yellow vests plaguing him. And obviously, Great Britain, they can't send their top leader because she is attending to, you know, Brexit. And the president of the United States doesn't want to go or something like that.
So well, he was going to send a diplomatic team, and that was canceled last week, shortly after he canceled Nancy Pelosi's trip, and then there was backlash.
But not
over
Melania's
the,
trip.
Okay, but
yeah, on the big plane.
But there you go.
Yeah. So the answer is Davos has been somewhat downgraded in terms of its importance. However, the New York Times did a good job, as you just pointed out, and I want to defer to Fran Berman, who has a sheath of notes in front of her that she'll now deliver to us.
Yeah, prepare for my speech. It's interesting to me as I read this, you know, it always reinforces how global the world has become. The big companies are all multinational, and they have to pay attention to the global economy. When we do something in this country, it always has impacts. When Chinese do things, it has impacts. This will have impact. Their slower growth will have impact between them and the United States. It'll also have impact on parts of Africa and Australia. And so, you know, you see these folks gather in Davos, you know, the famous and the leaders and all of those folks, and you kind of get the tone, at least
hoi
from the
polloi.
Reporting.
Can we use that?
The hoi polloi. But then you get the tone from the news media about how much the economy is really a focus this time and how anxious everyone is. And everybody, you know, two words, global recession. And we're all worried about that. So, mm-hmm. you know, that I think is what we're hearing. And that's what people are starting to read into these numbers, which are, you know, concerning.
Well, I saw the numbers from China, and you have to imagine that a country growing at 6.6%, that's still a tremendous year, even though it's their lowest in 28 years. A country that large cannot sustain growing at that high of a rate for that long. It's also remarkable to me that all of this tumult is happening globally and so much uncertainty, yet the U.S. stock market didn't have a great year last year, but it is still holding up in a big way, which means there is confidence from investors and people that are invested in the market that things are hopefully going to be okay in both the short term and the long term. But with all this stuff overhanging, of course, the people in Davos are going to be showing concern and all that. I did see that there are, I think, 1,500 private planes that landed in Davos, which is almost double the number of private planes last year. So the people at the very top, they're doing well. They've got new planes.
Well, maybe they're just sending a lot of their underlings because the big guys aren't going.
That's possible.
I'm just teasing.
I think that our absence from this is indicative of our waning position in the world. We were the world's leader. We were a leader, an economic leader. And the tariffs and the shutdown have undermined our ability to speak credibly about anything. And this man, the orange menace in the White House, really doesn't understand world economics. I don't even think he really understands economics. I just think he understands debt and how to use it, just like Joseph Kennedy did. I mean, he made a mint. Kennedy did during the Depression because of debt. But I think that, you know, we're in a very precarious position with someone in the White House who really doesn't understand the United States' position in all of this. And he doesn't care that he doesn't understand. And that's really dangerous.
Well, and the scary thing, you know, I really hear you. And the scary thing is that we can go more towards sort of an isolationist America first kind of approach. But we're all connected. So yeah. What that means is that we lose our competitive edge and we lose our influence, and not understanding how we fit into the bigger picture and how important that bigger ecosystem is for us to do anything in this country is a serious concern.
We have to remember that we were isolationist after World War One. We had these folks who didn't want us to get engaged in anything, and there we have the Great Depression. You know, in some respects, well, we weren't really isolationists before the Great Recession, but we certainly didn't do our homework as well as we should have and spent money that we didn't have, while the Republicans tried to cut taxes at the same time of engaging in multiple wars and multiple fronts.
Well, you know, you make an interesting point here about the potential for a recession. You know, for a long time in California, Fran, you come from California, yeah. You know about everybody's always predicting the big one is coming, right? The big one's coming.
That's the big earthquake.
That's right.
Everybody's always predicting.
That's right. And now on the stock market, people have been saying, all the great economists, and so many of them have been saying the big one is coming. We're going to have another major recession that's going to come. But if I'm Donald Trump, I'm up there and I'm saying, you know, don't give me that. We're doing extremely well. Just look at the market numbers. There was a brief down surge and now it's upsurge. And so don't be telling me that we're not doing well, because we are.
Well, I also think that if you did see the United States truly going towards isolationist policy, you would see a huge global downturn. The truth is that we are still the world's biggest trade leaders, the biggest trade partners with almost every country. And what I think the administration is trying to do, you know, you talk about tariffs, they're trying to change trade policy that was implemented when China was basically a third world country. And they're not making, in my opinion, dramatic changes to those trade policy. They're making relatively minor changes to try and make it fairer when we trade with Mexico, Canada, China. And of course, that makes big news. I don't think that it's as dramatic as some would.
If you'll allow me to riff off Alan's comment about earthquakes,
a minute, but go ahead.
For a bit, the San Andreas Fault is the big fault line that runs through California, and Southern California geoscientists tell them is due for a major earthquake. And so what Californians are doing are they're preparing for it. They're doing building codes. They're trying to make sure that, you know, infrastructure is retrofitted. You know, essentially that's what we have to do for our economy. We have to prepare for a global recession. We have to, you know, make sure that, you know, these things are stable and consistent. And, you know, that seems like a really strategic thing to do.
What would you do?
Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to give Fran some time to figure out exactly, solve this problem. She'll have about 3 minutes to
JP
solve the problem.
JP will tell us.
And then we'll be back with that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this Tuesday, the 22nd of January, 9:34 on the Tuesday, and it would be posters here. J.P. Miller, Fran Berman, and Alan Chartok. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org, and we have a few of those. We'll go to those right now.
Where are they?
Right here. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
You're
right.
Welcome.
Very few. Okay. And we've heard from Gina, who says, working for no pay. Serious question. Could states pay federal workers and SNAP benefits out of emergency funds, then sue Trump's administration for reimbursement plus penalties? 800,000 people working without pay should be leading to a revolution. Well, Gina, let me take the first at that. I like the idea that you are quite right. Some states are now giving federal workers some benefits out of their own money. And that's going to happen. But they're not going to sue the federal government and get the money. That's my view of it. It's that simple.
Well, David Leonhardt yesterday, I think that's how you say his name, who's an op-ed writer for The Times, wrote about why aren't people taking to the streets? Why uh-huh. isn't this happening? And how effective is he cast a larger perspective on the resistance. And, you know, the resistance should be taking this to the streets. And, you know, I think we're not France. We're just not.
Right.
We're not friends.
Exactly right. It's a matter of something I have talked about many times here called national character, a now discredited academic concept, but I still believe in it. I think that the French are the French. They started with the guillotine and all the rest of that stuff. They have perpetual revolution. That's what's my the philosopher Jean-François Bizayon is talking about that right now. He owns a coffee shop in our town, and he is right. He's French, and he knows what he's talking about. The French have a specific character. So do the Brits. So do we.
Right. We've never had a national day of a strike like they have in France, like they have in other European countries. And the union movement, while I support it and I think it's important, has been somewhat emasculated, especially by the Republican administrations. So it makes it more difficult for people to say, let's go out and strike.
Our unions are not radical, that's for sure.
You know, suing won't. Help the whole problem. I was talking to a friend in D.C. who works for one of the research and development agencies, and she was talking about, you know, when she goes back to work, she'll be able to be paid. I mean, it's kind of a struggle now because she's got bills now, but the people who won't get paid are, you know, the metro's losing money. The people who clean up the buildings, are contractors who cannot get money. The people at the lunch places that all the federal workers go are losing money. It's a huge impact on the economy, and those people can't sue.
And how about the people who can't eat because their benefits have been taken away from them? You're not going to get that back again.
All the people who are going to get thrown out of their federal housing.
Oh, my God. You know, I've been reading some heartbreaking things about people can't pay their rent. Well, there was trying to throw them out.
A letter in the New York Times, or an article in the New York Times this morning about just that subject, about the shutdowns, pain cuts deep for the homeless and other vulnerable Americans. And it is a very serious issue, and one that basically the article looking at the Department of Housing and Urban Development is one of the federal agency hit hardest by the shutdown as it grinds on to its...
I also think that we are, as Americans, are kind of trained to believe, oh, okay, it's another day. This will get resolved in the next couple of days or the next week. Mm-hmm. And it's very possible that we're in early days of this shutdown. Neither Trump nor Schumer and Pelosi are showing any signs of giving any inches on their side. And both Schumer and Trump and Pelosi, they all think that the shutdown is working to their advantage, that it's hurting the other people worse than it's hurting them.
Yeah.
So we're going to see more and more horror stories, and I wouldn't discount having a real sense of outrage in the country and maybe some demonstrations that show how outraged people are, not just the people that aren't getting paid, but the people that see their fellow Americans not getting paychecks. We all have that sense of missing a paycheck is about the worst thing you can. Why not?
No, that's not the question. Come on.
Why not?
I'm asking you, are they going to take to the streets? I'm not asking why not.
If it goes on much longer, I think I don't see why it wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Back to Joe's point, 95%, I read, of the people in HUD are furloughed.
Right.
95%. That's a huge amount.
Mm-hmm. So on the same subject that JP just brilliantly articulated, we are now hearing from Anne, who says, "Good morning, dear panel." I like that part best. "Now, about the shutdown, I'm a registered Democrat and a never Trumper. However, I believe Nancy and Chuck bear equal responsibility for the shutdown with Trump and McConnell. Read the Washington Post article, which quotes several prominent Democrats speak in favor of barrier along the border before the age of Trump. Why couldn't NP have offered to negotiate
NP, Nancy
and Pelosi?" Don't do that, everybody. Just write it down.
They want to stay within the 140 characters.
Yeah, well, nor did she. Why couldn't Nancy and Chuck have offered to negotiate for a truncated version of a barrier? The money would probably not even been spent before 2020. I believe she and Chuck want to use this moment to deny Trump the key to re-election. They're all about playing politics, not about principle. Shameful." I heard Tom Brokaw this morning on the air, and he was saying much the same stuff.
I think everybody's trying to
win. What was Tom Brokaw saying, Alan?
Saying it is joint responsibility all around. But by the way, I realize that I'm much older now because I saw Tom Brokaw. Boy, he looks very different, much older. Anyway, if I weren't so interested in voting in next year's present primaries, I changed my registration to Democratic. Thanks for the opportunity to vent. Now, Anne, if you lived in a good state like Massachusetts, you would know that you could register as not an independent, but as a non-registered voter and vote in either primary.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I thought I'd mention that to you. Okay. And that's from Anne. And Stuart wrote us a note and says, no, it wasn't Stuart. Stuart's name is on the account. It's actually from Lori. The common people, not the high and mighty, a common mistake. Mm-hmm. Did I get that one?
I'm not sure. Lori, we don't know what you're referring to.
The common, not the, me. Hoi polloi, I get it.
Oh.
See, means the common people, not the high and mighty.
Oh, really?
A common mistake.
Interesting.
You know, I thought that when it went by, too, to tell
Thanks.
You the truth, but I wasn't quite sure, so shut up.
Well, isn't that how it's usually used?
I think it's been used in many ways and probably often the wrong way.
Okay, and so this is very interesting. But to go to Davos, you have to have a lot of money to go to Davos to get in, to do the party.
Just to be invited. It's very hard to
get
invited.
Yeah, so we're talking about people who are doing pretty well.
You could do it the way that Roselle once did it while traveling through Greece.
Yeah.
She sold her blood.
Oh, God.
That's a true story. She sold her blood.
Oh, God.
To get a railroad ticket.
All right. Let's go back to other things. In a segment I'm going to call Hypothetical Rudolph Giuliani.
I thought that was great. It's all hypothetical.
Giuliani said that you'll remember on Sunday, Rudolph Giuliani, the lawyer for the President of the United States, was on the Sunday talk shows, and he said that the proposed Trump Tower project and discussions and negotiations had gone on right up until the end of the campaign. I guess up until the time that the president took office. Yesterday, Rudolph Giuliani desperately tried to walk that back and said that his comments were hypothetical and not intended to convey facts.
Joe, why does he have any credibility at all?
I don't know.
That's just what I want to know.
I don't know. Well, because he's the lawyer for the President of the United States. The President of the United States is sending out his lawyer to speak on his behalf.
Right. That's correct.
And on his behalf, he is saying that the comments that he made are hypothetical and are not intended to convey facts.
And the reason he's saying that is because every time he says something, he gets a call from the president who says, you shouldn't have said that. And so he walks it back. This is he's being played like a yo-yo.
Either
okay,
that.
Okay, so let me revise my question. Why does what he says have any credibility at all?
Because Joe said the guy's the president of the United States.
Well, I don't, and it probably doesn't ultimately, but it does when you think, okay, let's say in a normal situation, right? Somebody is charged with something. You don't talk to that person, but they send their lawyer out to talk to the press to answer the questions about whatever infraction they committed or are accused of committing. And you come back and you say, well, this is what their lawyer said. This on their behalf, this is what their lawyer is saying. So we expect that this is what their lawyer said. And now we know that it's hypothetical and not intended to convey facts.
Joe, I think you may be, respectfully, you may be missing something here. And that is, this guy's in the corner, or he's in the middle of the circle. We're talking about the president. And he sees the circle encroaching on him. And as I've used the analogy about the rat in the corner before, every time something new comes out about him, Giuliani reacts, usually, I suspect, at what he's been told by the president to do. And inevitably, it turns out to be the wrong thing that he said. And he gets yet another telephone call from the president whose circle is encroaching on him. I think that's what's going on here. Giuliani is just reacting to the stimuli that have been presented by the president.
Right, but I was answering Fran's question, which was why does it still have credibility?
He's the president.
Right. Yeah, it still has to have credibility, right?
I think there are a number of factors at play with Giuliani. One is he is the president's lawyer, and if you watch an interview of his, I would say about 80% of the stuff he says is a reasonable defense of the president and trying to explain the Mueller probe.
That seems to skew very high to me.
You think it's less than 80%?
Don't you think
okay.
so?
Well,
you think 80% of it's true?
I wouldn't say true, but it is an effective messaging for the president's point of view. Whether the president's point of view is true, that's a whole different thing.
Okay.
But
all right.
I would
I'm
say
with you.
20% are total news bombs, where he totally makes news and says stuff like, to Chris Cuomo the other day, I never said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign. That was just, you know, 3 or 4 days ago.
Right. Pure desperation.
He is the president's lawyer. That being said, if Rudy quit or got fired, no one else would want that job. So Rudy is kind of an unfireable guy. And another thing about Rudy is if most lawyers for president, before going on to a news show, would have their talking points and would do preparation. I think Rudy is totally undisciplined, does no preparation, and just talks out of his ear. And it's every day with this Rudy Giuliani.
Yes, yeah, it's something a little lower, I think.
While he is making huge trouble for the president, he also is kind of the only game that Trump has right now. He can't get another lawyer.
By the way, he can get another lawyer, and he can fire Rudy Giuliani, and he will fire Rudy Giuliani when that moment comes, JP, that he thinks, you know, this is indefensible, and he is calling the shots, not Giuliani. It isn't that Giuliani is going out there and just talking off the top of his head. Giuliani is on a short leash held by the president.
I mean, so this goes back to my personal theory, which is that the only metric of success these guys have is, can I be in the news every
right.
single day?
Yeah.
And they're doing spectacularly well at that. They're doing brilliantly at that. They're in the news every single day. It's for a lot of dumb stuff. It's for a lot of waffly stuff. It's for stuff that doesn't
but
make sense.
But they spell his
they're
name
in the
right.
news every single day.
Well,
and
there's
that's
a
the
quote.
Axiom.
There's a quote in the New York. No, I'm sorry. There's a quote this morning that is floating around from Giuliani, in which he says that he's in trouble because you know, the president is not an easy client, and he doesn't know what to do about that. And he's going to be known forever on his tombstone as, quote, the man who lied for Trump.
Well, this is the point I wanted to make. He's gone from being America's mayor.
That's right.
On 9/11.
That's right.
And having, you know,
yeah.
Bush hold his coat for all intents and purposes.
Yes. Wait, that's an Andrew. That's a famous
yeah,
Andrew
you know, to being a America's mealy-mouthed spokesperson for somebody who doesn't know the truth from fiction or lies. And I think, Fran, you're right. It's about how much do I get in as long as they spell. It's the old axiom. I don't care what they write as long as they spell my name right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But his credibility is shot. And One can only wonder if this really is so calculated, as Alan, you're saying, that Trump is pulling the strings. It's just one more example of how they are obfuscating the entire situation to take attention away from the real problems,
could
the
be.
Real issues.
Could be. But I also believe that Trump's there. We have story after story about it. He sits in the White House. He watches the big screen TV. He's upset by what he is seeing. He gets on the phone impulsively, and he tells Giuliani he said the wrong thing. And no matter what Giuliani says, he's going to get told that it was the wrong thing.
Oh, you think so? No matter what he says?
I do.
He's going to be told.
Because the president is caught in what we used to call Saluji. Or man in the middle when you're throwing the ball over the guy's head, and it gets shorter and shorter,
shorter. And he's going to get hit.
I think that in general, Trump, if Giuliani's going on TV all the time to defend the president, that is at the direction of the president. So the president must have some confidence that he's an effective communicator for the White House's position on the Mueller probe. Now, he's let out two or three unbelievable news bombs over the last week that that Trump can't be
Giuliani
happy with.
Now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Trump has to have confidence that he is being an effective messenger, or else he wouldn't let him on TV. I don't think Rudy's just booking these interviews by himself. I think it's at the direction of the White House.
Well, I think that's probably true. I'm sorry, Joe.
No, and especially to your point, JP, because he was away for a long time. Remember when there was the Giuliani hibernation?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously now they brought him out to do exactly as you described. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the roundtable and panel discussion. Breaking just as we were in our break, the Supreme Court revives the ban on transgender military service. The Supreme Court voted 5-4 to temporarily reinstate the administration's policy, which lower courts had blocked in the face of legal challenges. The ban makes exceptions for several hundred transgender people already serving openly and for those willing to serve in, quote, their biological sex. Libby, what would you like to say about this?
Well, I think it's just one more example of Mike Pence's influence on this administration. You know, during the campaign, Trump held up a rainbow flag and said he was going to be the best friend to the LGBT community, and it's been nothing but a total horror show. But this is Mike Pence. Mike Pence is as homophobic as they come. His wife is now back to teaching at a school in Virginia where you can be fired for being a gay or lesbian or transgender person. They're not allowed to talk about it. And so this is his doing. And it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. There are already many transgender people serving with honor and doing their jobs. And it's just, it makes absolutely no sense. It's just one more last vestige of a radical Christian right that is dying, and they're using this administration to get in as much as they can before the younger people in those churches say bye, because they already are saying goodbye and they're losing their political clout.
So let me disagree with you.
Okay, fine.
For change. Look, Libby, Mike Pence, of course, is everything you say he is. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. On the other hand, look at the propensity of Trump to play to his base, which is hold up your finger in the air and let the wind blow, and you know where he's going to go for that redneck basically thing. And one of the things is going to be anti-homosexual, anti-lesbian, anti-transgender, because that's where his people live. It's that simple.
I agree with you. That is where they live.
So it's not only Mike Pence that's calling the shots.
No. I think it is Pence calling the shots, with the president realizing, oh, this is good for me. Because I don't think that this is even on his radar, to be quite honest with you. I don't think Trump really thinks about this stuff. It's not on his radar. Pence brings it to the table. Trump realizes, oh, my people will like
Pence
this.
Pence is his evangelical whisperer.
That's right.
Well,
he really
is. And Pence ran on these issues.
That's right. He did.
I mean, while running for governor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Indiana was the state that was going to make it legal to discriminate against LGBT people, and all the businesses went crazy and said, don't do this because we're going to lose business, which they did, but he did it anyway. And they've lost a tremendous amount of business. North Carolina has lost a tremendous amount of business. Netflix just pulled out of doing a film, I think, in North Carolina. Hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue because they still have the law in the book saying it's okay to discriminate.
The big thing here for me, though, is the 5-4 decision, which we're going to get used to that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, 5-4 is interesting because, you know, you got a couple of Republicans who obviously didn't go along.
Well, it was Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan who dissented.
Right.
So Breyer is here. Republican? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it all comes back to the general meta theme of, you know, can you do the job? Like, who cares what body parts you have, who you want to sleep with, what you believe, what gender you are, you know, what religion you are? Can you do the job? And all of these things come to focus on, you know, all those other things, which Breyer, are kind of irrelevant.
Breyer was appointed by Clinton.
And also coming from someone who didn't put on the uniform himself, and these people are willing to put on the uniform.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing, I think.
Yeah. It's, I mean, we've gone through Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know, we know how bad that was for lesbians and gays in the military. People now serving openly because the Obama administration made it easier. You know, it's like, what's the big deal? Because you don't understand
do
it.
Right?
Because you don't understand it, then you have to hate it. And yes, they can do the job. But it's really about fear, not understanding, that not understanding turning into fear, and fear turning into hate. It's,
yeah.
Joe, back to your, Joe, back
just
to your
focusing
point.
On the wrong
You're
stuff.
Absolutely right. We can look forward to these 5-4 decisions.
All right, let's do a couple of letters. We're going to have to take a break in about a minute, but we'll do a couple of letters, and then we'll move on.
Okay, Andy says, Davis. China's economy is, it says Davis. But,
Davos?
Davos is what you meant. China's economy is slowing down, and Chinese government's growth numbers are not necessarily based on economic facts. The U.S. economy is the strongest in the world, hence the strength of the dollar. There's the demand for dollars because of the world's desire to buy U.S. assets. That's from Andy. Okay. And Richard says, perhaps we need a constitutional amendment. Government shutdowns are an attack on the foundations of responsible government and endanger economic stability. Perhaps one of the Democratic hopefuls will make a pledge to push a constitutional amendment to bar government shutdowns. It is the right thing to do, and it would be difficult for an opponent to present themselves as advocates of governmental shutdowns. You know, Richard Leverett, who writes this quite frequently and is very on target, but Richard, the one thing I would suggest to you is all it takes is Mitch McConnell sitting up there and saying, okay, everybody's for this, but we're not going to bring it to the floor. We're not going to allow it to happen. And that's what's been happening. And Sue says, good, though cold morning. Don't forget that Don's best bud, Lindsay, was able to jet off to Turkey, so it's not just Melania. You know, that's a very interesting point. Keith says, working without pay. Panel, being forced to work for over a month without pay sure doesn't sound like forced labor or slavery to me. This has gone on long enough. These poor people should strike. The old saying goes, should schmutz. Pete says, national strike. Panel, I believe after Kent State, we had numerous college strikes, and on October 15th, 69, we had a national moratorium day to end the Vietnam War. So I think we do have experience with this. Yeah, but not Pete, not with people in the, with pots and pans coming out by the millions into the street.
And not in, what, 40 years?
Yeah. Okay.
One more and we'll take a break.
All right. Shutdown, says Lori. Okay. What is happening to people in homeless shelters and subsidized housing? And by the way, the Daily News this morning and the New York Post are filled with stories about freezing people with no heat and what's going on in some of these houses.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a lot of letters. We'll go to those right now. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. And Alan, you should have some in front of you there.
Well, we heard from John, who said transgenders in the military. Good morning, panel. I am not a redneck nor a Christian, and I'd like to take issue with being cast as one for disagreeing with allowing transgenders in the military. They have strict codes of conduct necessary for conducting war, and I think allowing transgenders in the military may complicate that.
Well, that would be transgender people, number one. And number two, they're already in the military, and things have not gotten complicated.
I'm with you, Libby. Okay. What the heck here? I don't know. Are we reading letters? We're reading letters.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Luke says, JP just committed pundit malpractice by not mentioning McConnell's role in all of this. He has the real power here and refuses to bring it to a real vote. I think I just mentioned that, didn't I?
You did, but I didn't. And yeah. I feel like the Congress passes the bills and Trump signs it. You know, Trump would veto it.
Right.
Trump, I think that it's Trump versus Schumer and Pelosi, not Trump and McConnell. I don't think McConnell has any say in it.
Oh, I do. I think he could go right into the president and say, look, we need to do this. Too many people. My constituents are hurting. I mean, he's from Kentucky. Of course his constituents
are
hurting.
Not only that, he has done that. Yeah. We know that.
And, you know, and he could make this happen if he wanted to.
But most of the time, he doesn't. Right. Most of the time, he does exactly what he's told.
Well, I should have mentioned McConnell, so I apologize.
Okay. Can you get insurance for pundit malpractice?
Yes. Okay. Pundit malpractice. I have
Let me know later where I go.
Corey says, national character. The reason the so-called resistance is so important is because it is not as big as you would like. Quite simply, the majority of Americans are not as freaked out by the Trump presidency as the far left is. I'm very glad that we do not emulate France in their political sensibilities. This may be a bit ethnocentric, but I believe the American character is far superior to the character in France. I'm sorry. The American character is one that says, let's help ourselves and our own communities before we stick our hand out to the government. I'm very proud that strain is alive and well in this country. I don't understand those who would prefer an American population that can only find solutions to problems through government action. And that's from Corey. All right. And then from Anthony, we heard, can it be the fact that France and Great Britain are somewhat more homogeneous than we as Americans? And can that be the reason why France can strike more nationally than we do here in America? That said, 2 years ago, we had the Women's March on Washington, a great statement. Anthony.
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's certainly true that both those countries, you know, have been there for hundreds, thousands of years. And so there is, you know, definitely a history with their people that we do not have. But this country has always been created from diversity. And so, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting comment. I
agree with you, Fran, as always. Melinda said, Nancy and Chuck, seen in December, if the Democrats give in to Trump, who's to say he'll, quote, honor his end of any deal? And as has been said many times, what then stops Trump from doing the shutdown every time he doesn't get his way? Boy, I'm with Melinda on that one. I think she's exactly right. Cassandra says, shutdown consequences. Hello, all. I think about veterans receiving disability and health care benefits from the VA and possibly retirement benefits from DOD could be affected as well. And whether these folks will receive these earned benefits, my ex-husband receives disability and health coverage. My worry is that he will not get paid and not be able to pay daycare and health insurance premium for our son. We are not federal employees, yet we may be impacted if this continues, and that's from Cassandra.
Absolutely.
And Gail says, why? Can you explain about why people are desperate to get into the U.S.? What have we done in their better countries to precipitate? What have we done in their countries to precipitate their movements to this country? Thanks. Anybody on that one? JP? No.
Sorry.
Luke says, words. Hoi polloi often gets confused with hoity-toity. Oi.
I love
very
that.
Very clever from Luke. And Betsy says, shutdown. Hello, glorious panel. Mitch McConnell holds the cards on this one. The Republicans actually refused to fund the wall. However, a bipartisan bill would pass that included funding for border security. He could do it. This is totally on him and Trump fearing Republicans in the Senate. Thanks, and that's from Betsy. And from Kurt, it's Trump shutdown. I find it hard to believe that I'm getting better reporting on this from Shep Smith on Fox News than I am from WAMC. This is all of Trump's shutdown. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer do not own this. Trump owns this by his very own words. Every time someone says on the air something about this shutdown, it should be followed up with a recording of Trump saying, I will own this shutdown. Please stop laying it on the feet of Nancy and Chuck. Those aren't the facts. You know, Kurt, it is true that somebody on the panel may have said it, but don't act like it's the whole panel that is saying it, because it's not. And that's a very important distinction. So there. And Maureen says, question, isn't Giuliani working for free? I don't remember that one. I think I heard something about that.
Don't know the answer to that.
Tricia says, the ease of protesting in the streets. I read somewhere that one of the reasons that the French protest in the streets more often is due to the smaller size of the country and the available rail service that brings people easily into Paris. Americans can and do protest in the street, the Women's March, for example. But it's harder for all of the protesters to congregate in Washington, D.C. And we heard from Jeremy, Pence's wife. From what I read, the school that Mike Pence's wife works at also will not accept LGBTQ students. That's right.
Absolutely right. No.
And John says, Giuliani Trump, when questioning the tactics, actions of this administration, could it be possible that nothing matters to them other than their ultimate goals of small government, big business, and personal greed? They will use the power of the executive branch to bully their way through anything that gets in the way. Thank you very much. All right. And one more, Joe. No, not one more.
Two more.
Yeah. Okay. And we heard from Leslie, who says, asylum bill is up and is a scam. Trump's so-called compromise essentially guts asylum for Central Americans. Also, asylum determination will be made by DHS. No judicial review. Dems cannot agree to this. And that's from Leslie. And then we heard from Lillian. My submarine serving spouse, recently retired, finds this ruling a word not appropriate to use. Only one thing matters. Can you do your job? Your gender or gender identity has nothing to do with your ability to serve effectively in the armed forces. Lillian said that.
Amen.
All right, let's move on to some other topics in our few minutes that we have left, about 15 to be, or about 10 minutes to be exact. We go to the, we've been talking a lot about Facebook and what they're up against. U.S. regulators have met to discuss imposing a record-setting fine against Facebook for privacy violations. Fran Berman, how much will it be?
I don't know, but it should be more than $22 million, which is the last big fine they said, and that was to Google in about, 2012, I think. But this is a really interesting article, and it's an article that just heads up everybody. This is the year of data privacy, and I think we're going to see more and more the public sector, FTC and Congress, really take action here. And so the story here is that FTC regulators are imposing a fine on Facebook for going against It was called some sort of a document or decree that they had for them about the privacy of their users. So now they're violating that. They're using users' information. Think Cambridge Analytica. Think that information being used without permission and without consent. Interestingly, today we just heard from France, our current favorite country in this roundtable, with GDPR, now Google has been levied $57 million for roughly the same kinds of issues. So we're really going to see governments take more of a step in terms of consumer data privacy, what companies can and cannot do with your data. And of course, at the end of the day, there are big and bad repercussions of your data getting used by companies without your permission, often, to limit your options.
How much does a fine have to be to have a real effect on these companies?
Well, that's a really good question because, of course, these companies make, unimaginable amounts of money. And with GDPR, there's actually substantial fines that have to do with the income. I believe it's 4%, but I'm not sure, for companies in Europe. GDPR is really setting the tone for governments all around the world. In the U.S., we do not have sufficient consumer privacy legislation. And so the FTC is really doing a lot of the heavy lifting. But the FTC does not have a great track record in being really aggressive about this on behalf of consumers. So people are talking about that the fine levied And it's not clear yet because they're still doing the discussion, but they say it'll be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, that's no small change.
Which I actually do think it's small change to Facebook, especially because they are a monopoly. They don't have competitors where, oh, a fine will affect their competitive position. They have a monopoly. They bought Instagram, and whatever the fine is, they're simply going to pass on to consumers, which is almost every American.
Well, the consumer confidence in Facebook has really dipped. It's dipped since all of the since Cambridge Analytica, since the discussion of what, you know, Facebook is doing with your data, and you know, America is a place where there's lots of innovation. You're starting to see people interact in other media, in other forms, in other ways, and you know, Facebook started small too. I think Facebook's not going to be able to hold that monopoly forever.
I understand that there's less consumer optimism about Facebook, but the people that I interact with are all still addicted to Facebook. And there's a lot less consumer optimism, less with heroin, and there are more heroin overdoses. People are addicted to Facebook. All of America is addicted to it. They can't give it up, and there's a monopoly. And there's no competition.
You know, but look at millennials. Millennials are the folks to look at. They grew up in this digital world. They've never seen a world without it. And they're starting to find exactly the social media that suits them. And it's not always Facebook.
It's a good point. On the other hand, I'm old, but I love to look at my grandchildren on Facebook and on Instagram. So I don't worry about the politics of the organization as much as, and you may well be right about this, Fran, about the millennials who are coming up and who will make all the decisions.
Well, it's interesting. I look at my own kids, and right now, my daughter, who owns a dance studio and is a professional dancer herself and uses media a lot to reach both her clients and her audiences, she uses Facebook in the same way that I use LinkedIn as a professional venue. For personal venues, she uses other things.
I think you also have to think with the amazing thing about Facebook is our humans' eyeballs are so valuable to media, television stations, advertisers, and our eyeballs spend way more time now on Facebook than they do on television. And television had competing networks with competing advertisers trying to get people's attention, people's spend, people's advertising dollar. Facebook now has almost a monopoly on that.
I don't know. I think they're on the other side of the Gartner hype cycle. I think they're going downhill. I think we are going to start seeing competitors. And I think that Facebook will have to change, too. I mean,
we have seen competitors, and they buy their competitors. We had Instagram.
Of course.
Instagram would have put them out of business. They bought them. And Zuckerberg was in front of Congress. They said, right. Who is your competitor? He couldn't name them.
WhatsApp.
He has a monopoly.
Well, I don't think it's going to be that way forever. And I also think
I hope it's not that way forever. I also think
that Facebook is going to have, you know, as we see this kind of rise in legislation around data privacy, and I think we will see data privacy legislation in this country, although it's now kind of stuck. I think that these will put needed public constraints on all of the companies, on Facebook, on Google, on, you know, all of the media we use, and we're going to start having some understanding about what the structures are that we're comfortable with in data privacy. So if you are in Vermont, there's a law about data brokers. People can't share your data without your knowledge or your consent inappropriately. If you're in California, you have a constitutional right to privacy, which we do not have in the United States of America, unless you're a child or with respect to your credit or your health data, but not a consumer right to privacy. So we're going to start seeing more of these laws in the states, and we're going to start seeing more of these laws federally, and they are going to make a difference in Silicon Valley, I believe.
All right, we have just a few moments, and I would like to talk about another story. We mentioned a little bit about this yesterday, but it was just as it was happening. Now we know a little bit more. But Kamala Harris has announced that she will be running for president, a first-term Democratic senator from California, who captured national attention for her grilling of Trump administration officials. She entered the 2020 presidential fray on Monday, casting her candidacy as a campaign to preserve American ideals. Stressing her experience as a prosecutor, she drew a clear contrast with President Trump without mentioning his name. She made the announcement, the official announcement, yesterday. And let me see. The future of our country depends on you and millions of others raising their voices to fight for American values. That's why I'm running for president, to lift those voices, to bring our voices together. She is the fourth female member of Congress to dive into an increasingly crowded Democratic presidential primary field and the first woman of color to be a top-tier candidate. She launches her campaign in the same week that Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman to run for president, started her bid 47 years ago. That from the from the LA Times.
I was pretty impressed with her yesterday. I watched her on the TV, and I thought that she had real gravitas. I thought that she was tough on her credentials, which were, you know, as a district attorney. So we're not talking about any, you know, far left thing here. As the attorney general of the state, as a United States senator, I don't want to compare her to anybody else because I just get a letter saying that it's not right. But I thought she did very well.
I thought she did a nice job. She's a tremendously smart, gifted candidate coming from California, is obviously an advantage from a big populous state like that. If she can win the nomination, I think she'd be extremely a formidable opponent for President Trump. The tough thing, of course, is that there are going to be two or three dozen candidates running for office. Can she put together the resources, raise the money, put together a national staff, and be on that first stage? I think what's likely going to happen with the Democratic primary this time is there's going to be the A debates, the B debates, and maybe even the C debates. Can she consistently be on the A debates and make a big name for herself? I will say I watched Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Colbert last night.
Yeah, she's unbelievable.
And she's a rock star. And as I look at the Democratic
But she can't run for president.
She can't run for president. She can in 2024. As I look at the current crop of Democratic candidates, none of them have that Ocasio-Cortez rock star quality that I think was a quality.
Well, Bernie used to have it, right?
Bernie could maybe bring that back. Maybe.
I don't think so.
But you look at Barack Obama had that rock star quality. Yeah. Trump, although people hate him, he was a media phenom. Ocasio-Cortez has that ability. Unfortunately, I don't think the Democratic candidates right now, no one has emerged as that rock star. But maybe someone will during the debates.
Yeah, I actually think that's really important, sadly, because I think charisma really matters in this country. And I think as we start seeing a lot of candidates come to fore, and there's some really interesting people, and I'm excited about Kamala Harris. I'm excited about, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand. I'm excited about a lot of people. And I'm eager to see what they really, really stand for. I think with respect to Kamala Harris, it will be really important for her to be able to reach not just the kind of constituency she'll see in California, but the constituency she'll see in the rest of the country.
Nor do I think Barack Obama was a rock star in the very beginning. I think he had to develop it.
He was always really charismatic, though.
State senator? It goes from first-term senator, just like Ocasio-Cortez, first-term congressman. He was first-term senator, gave the keynote, the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
People knew he was going to be the next president.
So we're out of time. Thank you very much.